Could you say you fools again?
Sure. You fools!
Oh. And maybe you could distill it down just to that vowel sound.
Ooh.
Yeah, right? I love it. Hello and welcome to the State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today joining us we have Erin Parton. Erin Parton is in her 13th season with the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. She's performed all over the country, places such as the Shakespeare Theater Company of D.C., Delaware Rep, Pennsylvania Shakespeare Company, among many others. Welcome to the program, Erin.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Erin, you've worked 13 seasons at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. What is it that makes Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey so special for you?
I'd have to say I started here when I was in my early 20s. I think I was 21 or 22, and I did their Shakespeare Live tour, and pretty quickly they put me into the main stage seasons and I became part of the family. And I think it's the family really that makes it a place that I want to continually come back to. Get to work with amazing actors, amazing designers, directors. It's that closeness, that kind of second home that I really treasure. I was speaking with Bonnie sometime, maybe the first week of rehearsal, and she has what she calls her company, a group of actors that she loves to work with. I'm lucky to be one of the ones who's brought back almost every season, but there is a large group of people who are brought back every other year.
Could you have guessed back when you first started that bus and truck tour that you would be at this Shakespeare Theater for 13 seasons and more?
No, I don't think when I started this career I ever thought I'd be anywhere for 13 seasons. It's such an up-in-the-air kind of career. While you're doing one job, you're looking for the next. So this has been pretty remarkable.
What are you working on there this season?
Right now, I'm just doing The Tempest, and they have not finished casting the season, and I will be going in to do a couple of auditions for some guest directors for later on in the season.
So you're working on Ariel and The Tempest. When does the show open?
We go into tech in about a week and a half, and then we open on May 31st.
So it's coming up.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
Ariel is an interesting character. She's one of a handful of characters who inhabit the tiny island where The Tempest is set. In the first speech, we learn that Ariel is a magical creature who serves Prospero. What is your approach to playing inhuman or supernatural creature?
Well, I think it's pretty incredible because Ariel, or any kind of supernatural character, has so few boundaries that you're kind of, from the get-go, set up to have endless possibilities. So you can try anything, and that's kind of a blessing. And then it's pairing out and finding the things that work the best for what we are creating as a group.
Do you try to bring humanity to the character?
Well, or do you help but, you know, be a human in the room? And there are times when Bonnie will say, like, and now you disappear. And I'm like, if I could, that would be amazing. If I could just become incorporeal and just bend. And one of the things that we have, I kind of quickly hit on early on in the process, I started, I don't know, moving my head into Prospero, kind of like a cat, rubbing my head onto his arm or something. And Bonnie said, cat-like. Yes, great, great. And then later on, she said, why don't we put in another animal, characteristics, a bird, you know? And so I have these quick, sharp movements with my head. And then I thought, well, we have to have a third animal. We have to have something else. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, iguana. Iguana's great because we have these great rock piles. I can climb up and perch. And so we have the lizardish quality of an iguana and the grace of a cat and the quickness of a bird. And to me, all those things kind of translate into a dragon, in a sense. So taking on animal characteristics lead me away from the humanness and cause me to find myself in weird shapes while standing, while perching, and different kinds of movements, qualities of movement than I would normally take on just as Erin.
Does the text inform you in any way?
Yeah, I mean, there are times when he calls me so many things. He used so many different adjectives to describe Ariel. My tricksy spirit, my dainty, all these different kinds of adjectives that led to different ways of being in those moments. Dainty definitely lends itself towards the bird. Tricksy, that's more of the cat. Those kinds of things I definitely have taken on.
I'd really like to hear these lines at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 2, where we're first introduced to Ariel. Would you read them for us?
Sure, from All Hail?
Yes.
All hail, great master, grave sir, hail. I come to answer thy best pleasure, be it to fly, to swim, to dive into the fire. to ride on the curled clouds to thy strong bidding task, Ariel, and all my quality.
Hast thou, spirit, performed to point the tempest that I bade thee?
To every article. I boarded the king's ship, now on the beak, now in the waist, the deck, in every cabin I flamed amazement. Sometime I'll divide and burn in many places. On the topmast, the yards, the bowsprit would I flame distinctly, then meet and join. Jove's lightning, the precursors, oh, the dreadful thunderclaps, more momentary and sight outrunning were not. The fire and cracks of sulphurous roaring, the most mighty Neptune seemed to besiege and make his bold waves tremble, yea, his dread trident shake.
Thank you, Aaron.
Oh, you're welcome.
Those are such evocative words. So the imagery there is very present.
Yeah.
And it's often remarked that the imagery may stem from natural phenomenon like will-o'-the-wisp.
Oh, sure.
St. Elmo's Fire. Does this production have any of those evocative elements?
What we've done, Bonnie had a great idea, because often our imaginations are so much more capable of creating what is being described of this tempest than what you possibly can put on a stage. So we are starting with kind of the storm that rages inside of him, this beautiful sound cue that she has created, of all these sounds that stir up in him, and then he turns and causes the storm. So then my description of this is much more important because it's talking about what they didn't get to see.
I noticed in your reading that you spend a lot of time either lengthening or shortening vowel sounds. Is that something you're doing just for Ariel, or that you tend to do in the roles that you play in Shakespeare?
It depends on the character. It is something. It's a tool in my tool belt, certainly. And some characters lend itself towards it more. I think that there are certain sounds that help the audience automatically understand what's being said. On certain line ends, if you hold and then pull into the next line of speech, it gives the mind time enough to collect what was just said and go on to the next imagery that's being placed there. And I think with this character, I do find that there are a lot of places where I use it. There are other places where it's very conversational, which is one of the great things about who she is. She appears, or it. It appears in so many different forms, and each form lends itself to a different way of using the text.
The next stop on Ariel's journey is perhaps the I want moment that occurs in Act 1, Scene 2. This is an instance where there are an awful lot of occurrences of shared lines. Can you tell us what a shared line is?
A shared line is where the beats of a line, the 10 beats are shared between two characters. So the first character might have 6 of them, and then the next character has 4. And it's a clue for us. Well, what you first try to do is often just come in immediately, because there are hints involved in that, something that you can get out of it. There's a reason Shakespeare did it that way. And there are also, you know, lines with just a 6 beat and not a shared line, which also gives us a clue of that there's a pause, and there's a reason there's a pause. So shared lines are great. They're a lot of fun to play with. And I think actually in the scene that you guys are talking about, they're very important. And it's because she's in great need, and the need is immediate.
Well, let's read that line. Jimbo, would you care to do
that? Oh, sure. Thanks. I'll do that.
These are the lines that begin in Act 1, Scene 2, with Ariel's line, "Is there more toil?"
Is there more toil? Since thou dost give me pains, let me remember thee what thou hast promised, which is not yet performed me.
How now? Moody? What is't thou canst demand?
My liberty.
Before the time be out, no more.
I prithee, remember, I have done thee worthy service, told thee no lies, made thee no mistaking, served without or grudge or grumblings thou didst promise to bait me a full year.
So Prospero has made promises that he's not keeping?
Well, yes, he has. And it's because he wasn't aware that this boat was going to come by at this time and he would have this great opportunity. And now there are things he needs to get done. But as a spirit, I don't really care what he needs to get done. I have my own agenda, and he needs to keep his word to me.
So Prospero has doorknobbed Ariel here? That's quite unjust.
It is. And it's the moment, because so often it's a male Ariel, but because I am female, this scene kind of came out like a married couple fighting one of the first times we did it. And it kind of fit in that regard, where both people are really in need of something. They really need to get something done, and, you know, tempers flare, and then we have to settle ourselves back down and attend to what is at hand. And he threatens me, actually, at the end of this scene. He threatens to do exactly what Sycorax did to Ariel and imprison me in a tree.
This complicates the relationship even more than I would have anticipated, because Ariel is very different from Caliban.
Yes.
Caliban, of course, is another magical creature who's indigenous to this island, but whose relationship with Prospero, although they are both servants and enslaved to Prospero's magic, is very different.
Yes. Watching that character be created and that specific relationship be created, there's kind of a bitterness that is involved between Prospero and Caliban.
Going back to the shared line for a second, I found it interesting that you talked about Ariel and Prospero in terms of a husband and a wife, because so often in Shakespeare, it is the husbands and wives that are sharing the lines.
Yeah, it's very useful and evocative to an audience, and they can relate to it immediately.
So in contradistinction to Caliban, Ariel has a pretty good attitude about her enslavement. And her speech is rich with songs and wordplay. An example is Act 4, Scene 1, where Ariel delivers a simple rhyme with a tricky rhythm. Would you like to read this little coda?
Certainly, yeah. Before you can say come and go and breathe twice and cry so-so, each one tripping on his toe will be here with mop and mow. Do you love me, master? No?
What is the significance of that final line? Do you love me, master? No. I find it I don't know, Jim. What's the word?
Yeah, I'm wondering whether she's asking him whether he loves her or doesn't love her. You could read it either way, or he's saying something to her between master and no.
For myself, there's a third choice, kind of. It's, do you love what I do for you? Does your affection, in our way of doing it, he starts to cross away. And I say, do you love me, master? He turns back and doesn't say anything, and gives me a look, and I say, no. And then he answers with, why, of course.
So there is something between the master and the no that prompts you to say no.
Right. It's, for myself, saying the do you love me, master, is more of like a, it's not quite so significant as the no. It's more of a flippant, like, you know I'm the best, right? Right? That's where the no, it becomes serious there.
Yes, yes, yes.
I see. So she's playful all the way through.
Mine is, at least. There are so many ways. You know, this is one of those great characters that, depending on who's coming at this language, it can be taken in so many different directions. The ending can be completely different with the freedom. My Ariel is a little feisty. She stands up for herself, and yet she is, I don't know, seductive at times and playful.
I mean, you're talking about the end of the play, and so why don't we go to one of those climactic moments where there's more shared lines in Act 5, Scene 1, but this time it's Ariel who is leading Prospero, and Prospero taking up the conclusion of Ariel's lines. Would you care to read it, and then we can talk about it?
Sure, yeah.
Garrett, it's your turn to play Prospero.
Oh, boy.
You guys are so good playing Prospero.
All right, here is Act 5, Scene 1. Prospero speaks. Now does my project gather to a head. My charms crack not, my spirits obey, and time goes upright with his carriage. How's the day?
On the sixth hour, my lord, at which time you said our work should cease.
I did say so when first I raised the tempest. Say, my spirit, how fares the king and his followers?
Confined together. In the same fashion as you gave in charge, just as you left them all prisoners, sir, in the lime grove which weather fends your cell. They cannot budge till your release. The king, his brother, and yours abide all three distracted, and the remainder mourning over them, brimful of sorrow and dismay. But chiefly, him that you termed, sir, the good old Lord Gonzalo, his tears run down his beard like winter's drops from eaves of reeds, your charm so strongly worksome that if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender.
Dost thou think so, spirit?
Mine would, sir, were I human.
And mine shall. My charms I'll break, their senses I'll restore, and they shall be themselves.
I'll fetch them, sir.
Aaron, I'm really touched by that last line you read, "I'll fetch them, sir." It felt a little bit as if you had accomplished an objective there.
Yeah, I think she does. There's a beautiful moment where she, this creature, this spirit who does not hold all of the same human emotions, is pointing out to him, look, this is what you've done, and you have to acknowledge it, and you cannot live in this place of denial and anger forever. And the fact that he comes around to that conclusion of, all right, okay, he has this great line, it's my favorite line in the play, the rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance.
Beautiful.
And that's it for me. It's, yeah, take the high road, take the rarer action. And so she does. She gets what she needs in that moment.
That's a really interesting observation. And it calls to question, what indeed does Ariel want? And whose humanity is at stake here? Ariel protests often that she isn't human. But yet the things that she's trying to evoke from Prospero don't necessarily lead directly to the attainment of her freedom, but rather an improvement of Prospero.
Yeah, I think she is. They've got to know each other over this long period of time, and she's a great observer of human beings. I think there's this moral compass that guides her. I think it is Prospero's humanity that's at stake. And the beautiful part for me is that he sees that through what I say, which is a very unlikely source for that to come from. He has to look at, wow, if you, a spirit who do not hold the same things as me, is willing to say that it would change you, why am I sitting here not taking a look at that?
And he is fundamentally changed by this exchange, isn't he?
Yeah, and the way Howard, the gentleman who's playing Prospero, the way he goes through that last little speech, there's so many beautiful changes in it, where he's bewildered first that, you know, you of spirit, are you to be more moved than I? And then, but they're high wrongs, I'm struck to the quick. And then he has to calm himself and my nobler reason, and comes back around to the, all right, yes, I'm going to go the virtuous path. And he has to, in the end, forgive his brother when he doesn't get any repentance from him.
There's another speech where you refer to the destiny of the sea, and it's evocative of a notion of karma.
Oh, yes. Garrett, are you talking about Act 3, Scene 3?
The harpy, yeah.
Yes!
My
yes.
favorite. Yeah, I love that session. And it's a really tough speech because you have to make sure you lay all of that in. That's where they find out why they're here and what is going to free them. You know, you have to look at your wrongs, and the only way forward now is repentance.
I'm dying to hear the speech, the harpy speech.
Oh, cool. We were just working on this morning.
Oh, this is great. So you're in rehearsal rehearsing this morning, and now we're going to do it now?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I might have to push you guys back a little bit. I'm a little loud on it. All right. You are three men of sin, whom destiny that hath to instrument this lower world and what is in't, the never surfeited sea hath caused to belch up you. And on this island where man doth not inhabit, you mongst men being most unfit to live, I have made you mad. And even with such like valor men hang and drown their proper selves. You fools! I and my fellows are ministers of fate. The elements of whom your swords are tempered may as well wound the loud winds, or with bemocked at stabs kill the still closing waters, as diminish one dowel that in my plume. My fellow ministers are like invulnerable. If you could hurt, your swords are now too massy for their strength and will not be uplifted. But remember, for that's my business to you, that you three from Milan did supplant good Prospero, exposed unto the sea him and his innocent child, for which foul deed the powers, delaying, not forgetting, have incensed the seas and shores, yea, all the creatures against your peace. Thee of thy son Alonso they have bereft, and do pronounce by me lingering perdition. Worse than any death can be at once, shall step by step attend you and your ways, whose wraths to guard you from, which here in this most desolate isle else falls upon your heads, must now be repentance and a clear life ensuing.
Boy, you just gave it to them.
Wow.
I try to.
Well, I just want to say that over the course of a play, you may not notice this, but in isolation, as we're reading all of these various speeches, the way you're using your voice changes with almost every speech, and it's terrific. It's just a joy to listen to.
Nice. Thank you so much.
Could I have permission to excerpt the you saying "you fools" as my ringtone?
Oh, heck yeah.
It's a really tricky speech. There's a lot of information you're giving, although the meter is fairly regular. I'm very interested in what will be line 60 on our website, which actually encompasses "you fools." It's often broken into a couple of separate lines, but in the folio, it's one line. And what's your take on it? I know you're saying "you fools" because the people you're talking to draw their swords.
Yes.
Do you think the speech changes at this point? Does Ariel change?
Yes. I think that Prospero gives Ariel things to do and things to say. And I think this is where Ariel goes off script. I think she goes off script from "you fools" all the way through "your swords are now too massy for your strengths and will not be uplifted." And then she gets back to what she's supposed to be talking about. "But remember, for that's my business to you." So I think this is Ariel getting feisty. It's, "Oh, you're going to pull your swords on me." So I think that's where she puts in her two cents and then gets back to what Prospero sent her to say.
Fantastic. I love it. Ariel with a temper.
Oh, yes.
There's one really crazy long line. It's line 66. I mean, we often talk about characters being in a state that they try to cram as much into one line as possible. Is that what's happening in that line?
She's just, it's one of those moments when you get so furious, everything's just coming out. You're just sending it all out, and you lose your temper on the road. One of those kind of moments. It could be an 11 line if "ministers" is "minsters."
Right,
which
"minsters,"
they may
right.
have done. Yeah, it would have to be an 11.
Right. It's either an 11 or a 12, but it's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I it's Shakespeare. If only we could ask him all of those things.
Aaron, I just want to sneak in one final question. And this is about Ariel's last line, which is what?
"Wast well done."
Which I find so endearing and so haunting. Why "wast well done"? Why that choice of words?
Well, there are a couple things I think about this. I think that Ariel, at least my Ariel, has a great pride in everything that she takes on and everything that she does. So there's the simple, "I did well, didn't I? I did it and beyond." But then there's, "Is it at an end? I need to know."
Ah, oh, that's beautiful as well. Aaron Parton, thank you so much for being here and for speaking to us on the State of Shakespeare.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. I've had a great time.
Aaron Parton is appearing as Ariel in the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey's production of The Tempest, which opens later this month. The details?
We open on May 31st. And we will be closing on June 22nd.
Aaron, thank you so very much.
I've had a blast. Thank you.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening to The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.